Welcome to a brand new edition of Freedom Books, Flowers and the Moon, the podcast brought to you each week by the Times Literary Supplement. My name is Stig Abel, the editor of the TLS. Joining me this week is not our cheese-devouring chum, Thea Leonarduzzi, who is otherwise engaged in purchasing large tracts of land in the British countryside. Instead, we have podcast regular, token northerner and indie pop star beyond compare, Lucy Dallas. Lucy, hello.
Hello. Thank you for having me.
How are you?
I'm all right. Thank you. I'm fine.
You've been drafted in because Thea is involved.
You make her sound like a kind of baron or a gentleman farmer purchasing large.
She sent me an email because I sent her this and she said she sounded feudal.
Yes, she did a bit. Yeah. It's a bit old school.
There is something of the Henry VIII about Thea, don't you think?
Really, very little.
Very little. Say, okay. Yeah. Well, I remember if you want to subscribe to the TLS, Google TLS subscriptions and type pod1 in the offer code section. You can get 6 issues for £6. Coming up on the show this week, it has been party conference season here in the UK. I used to have to go to them, sadly, and they are vile, sweaty hot boxes of political and often sexual frustration, reeking of booze and tribalism. Anyway, what have they revealed about the parlous state of British politics? James O'Brien, my former LBC colleague and peerless student of the game, will join us to discuss. We shall take full advantage of Lucy Dallas this week as an arts editor who speaks perfect French. Lucy, don't look at me like that.
I'm making a face. I'd just like it to be said that I do not speak.
But you do impress
French.
Me all the time with French idiom. What are the two that you've taught me recently? Think about pavements.
I can't possibly do this when there's a French person.
Well, she's not here yet. She's not here yet. Do the pavement. What's the pavement?
Oh, la dalle. J'ai la dalle.
J'ai la dalle, which means?
It means I'm hungry.
I'm hungry. But literally it means I have a pavement.
I think so. We can ask Muriel in a second.
And what was the other one? The other one was really good.
On n'a pas élevé les vaches ensemble.
We didn't.
Or garder les vaches ensemble.
Or pork.
Or les porcs, or les cochons.
Yeah, and that
means don't get too familiar.
Yeah, we didn't grow up on the farm together.
You can say that if someone's trying to call you tu and you don't want
that's
them.
That's right.
It's
yeah.
very old-fashioned.
But it's
and,
lovely.
And that probably wrong, as Muriel will tell us in a moment.
We're going to find out, but I don't think it is. And so the idea that if you call a French person tu instead of vous, they can say, we didn't raise cows together.
Yeah, we didn't grow up on the farm together, mate.
Yeah, I love that. Love a bit of French idiom. Anyway, which is good, because Muriel Zaga has reviewed Bernard Tavernier's documentary Voyage à travers le cinéma français and will be here to talk about what this reveals about French filmmaking. And TLS staffer and Welsh quota filler Samuel Graydon has been to visit the National Poetry Library in Royal Festival Hall to discuss the 50th anniversary of the Poetry International Festival.
This week, in our film issue, the critic and writer Muriel Zaga has been watching 40 years of French cinema for us, in the shape of Bertrand Tavernier's new film, Voyage à travers le cinéma français. A bit like Martin Scorsese's homage to the Italian and American films that influenced him, it includes clips from directors such as Marcel Carnet in the 1930s, who made Hôtel du Nord, Le Jour se lève and Les Enfants du Paradis.
Alors, je peux m'en aller?
Ben oui, vous êtes libre.
Tant mieux, parce que moi j'adore ça, la liberté.
Right the way through to Claude Sauté's Les Choses de la Vie from 1970.
Tu m'aimes parce que je suis là. Mais s'il faut traverser la rue pour me rejoindre, tu es perdu.
Muriel, welcome, and thank you for coming, and thank you for your lovely piece.
Just off air for agreeing with your French idiom.
And for, yes, thank you very much, particularly for that.
Exactly. There was a moment there where she could have said,
no, I've never heard
that. She's completely mad.
She's made it up.
Yeah.
Such power.
Yeah.
I wondered if you could tell us from the point of view of the film, first of all, what kind of director is Tavernier himself, and what is he best known for?
Well, Tavernier has been around for a while and is sort of woven into the fabric of French cinema, really. So I think he's one of those directors people take for granted. He's sort of part of the furniture. Mm. He's had a few hits. The greatest hit was probably Un dimanche à la campagne in the 1980s. I would say the 1980s was really his era,
yeah.
Which was a lovely sort of impressionistic study of family life. At the turn of the century, it's about a painter and his family in the house in the countryside, and it's very lovely. But he has made many different kinds of films. I think he doesn't feel particularly restricted to any particular genre, so has done science fiction, costume drama set in the Middle Ages, but also an adaptation of La Princesse de Montpensier, is a very eclectic director with a deep interest in all film.
Is that why he's done this? Is this a homage to the things that inspired him?
Or? Yes, so I think this is a way for him to... It's a self-portrait of Tavernier, the filmmaker and film buff. Two different kinds of hats, because unlike a director like Tarantino, for example, who's forever quoting and referencing the films he loves, Tavernier makes his own films, tells his own stories, and then has this other internal life of film buffdom where he is obsessed with various directors who have shaped him, but sort of subterraneously, really. So there are no very overt quotes or tributes in his own films.
Yeah.
But there are certainly a few film godfathers he references in this film. And so this is, it's really the story of his youth, because this film takes us from the 1940s to the 1970s in terms of decades of French cinema. Tavernier promises more. I think there will be an 8-hour television series to cover.
Because the documentary is already quite long, isn't it?
The documentary is 3 hours long, but of course he's had to edit, and a lot of people didn't make the cuts. But they will. They'll come later in the next installments.
We've got 8 more. This is already
very rich. This is already.
Is it a fun watch?
Yes. It's my area. I mean, I would say probably a little bit of previous knowledge of at least some of the most famous directors that are explored in the film would be useful. It'd be an idea to watch one or two movies of that period. Although, if you like film, then it's a fascinating story, and there is something universal about the dynamic between director and scriptwriter, between, you know, the dynamic between actors, those tensions and love affairs, creative love affairs between people in film, I think are universal. But in this, they are told in French.
As you say, he starts from how he started loving film and his own love affair with it. And he's got some very evocative early memories of going to the cinema. Can you tell us, there's a couple of lovely stories about the cinemas he went to when he was young.
Yes, so this is when he was a schoolboy and a lycéen and cutting classes in classic sort of Truffaut-like fashion.
It's a very filmic thing to do anyway, isn't it?
In order to go to the cinema instead. And so he grew up in Lyon, and he has fantastic anecdotes about sitting in neighborhood cinemas in Lyon, places called the El Dorado or the Pâté Palace, you know, with names like that. And so there was one place where, in between screenings, a middle-aged stripper would get up off her chair and perform a half-hearted routine before the next screen. You don't really get that nowadays, you know.
You just knew there was going to be an older woman. He's going to be, as a young French school, you knew an older woman was going to be creeping its way into the story to teach him about life at some point.
So that was very exciting, obviously. And then the most eye-popping one for me was, he remembers sitting in his seat at the cinema, and the man next to him opened a tin of peas, heated it up, so must have brought with him a small camping gas ring thing, and then ate it with a spoon out of the tin during the screening, which, again, is not something you come across very much these days.
I think we should do that.
Popcorn, isn't it, really?
Yes.
I know, wouldn't it be lovely if someone just did that now?
How
French to insist on hot food.
I know, and a tin of peas as well. There's none of that sort of Americanized junk you get in the cinema. Let's have some proper tin peas.
Let's have some veg.
Yeah.
They are lovely stories.
And so what films does he like? Because it's interesting, he doesn't really... We've got a big piece about Truffaut and the new wave. That doesn't seem to have made much of an impact on him. Is that right?
Well, I think it did have an impact, inevitably, because he's the same generation as Godard, essentially. And in fact, Godard has said... There's a line in the film where Godard says, Tavernier and I connect so well because we're both the children of the Libération after the war and the Cinémathèque. So there are points of contact. One of Tavernier's first jobs in film was to be the press agent for Godard's movies, and he does admire him, and also Agnès Varda, who is referenced in the film. But I think because Tavernier is essentially a man of the left who is very much rooted in the working reality of people's lives, there is something a little bit sort of ethereal and chichi about the landscape of the Nouvelle Vague, all those beautiful colours and cars and girls, that's not where he gets his nourishment from. I think he finds it all a little sort of shallow compared to the preoccupations he has.
Does he admire the auteur philosophy of the sort of new, you know, the sort of the show off, where the director's placing his stamp on a film?
Well, he's himself a fairly self-effacing figure, although definitely an auteur, who embraces that philosophy, but not a show-off, And it's very telling that this is a self-portrait, but it's delightfully free of ego, actually. It's really about admiration for other people's work. It's very rare that he says, and I also, of course, did this. You know, he doesn't really name drop his own movies or his own collaborations. It's about admiration, other people's works. The sort of life-giving power of admiration is one of the things he comes back to. Because there is a darker aspect to all this that he, again, in that typically self-effacing way, he doesn't tell his own story in detail, but the first film he saw when he was a child was when he was recovering in a sanatorium from tuberculosis with a damaged retina, permanently damaged retina. You know, you could read all kinds of things, and they are true. I'm sure that to be in that position as a very young child, he was six, see a movie for the first time, be able to see this astonishing, dazzling spectacle that would mark you for life. So I think it's really more of a deeply personal love of images, of the stories of images, a lot less about his own personality.
I think it's lovely, the idea of because they call them silhouette biographies, where you reveal a biography by the things around them. A sort of silhouette autobiography is kind of a very charming thing, isn't it? So here's me, but through my loves rather than by turning the camera directly on myself.
That's it. I mean, the film tells you a lot about Tavernier, the man, if you put it all together, you know, and the exclusions that you said, you know, not talking so much about the Nouvelle Vague, but talking about forgotten directors, forgotten movies, films that were salvaged by the skin of somebody's teeth before being melted, lost forever. You know, it's all about that, really. Those are the stories. So that, I think, is what makes him a film person.
Do you think that ties in with his idea about, and that's maybe in a way that the Nouvelle Vague, they were a bit too, like you say, a bit too chic for him, that he's interested in working people, in kind of real lives, and he's looking for what's not necessarily being observed?
Yes, I think it's very interested in the physicality of filmmaking. He's interested in speed, he's interested in the presence of human bodies in the frame, and really human interaction, and sort of universal stories, again, of human interaction. That's why I think a lot of the actors he talks about tend to be big film stars in France, but also character actors who made French films what they are.
Not the great beauties or the very glamorous kind of.
That's right. So he doesn't talk about Brigitte Bardot, for example, so much, although she's there. You know, she's there in Le Mépris, so her most distinguished film. But he does talk about Romy Schneider a lot. And Romy Schneider was a German actress, really, who became. It's one of those Jane Birkin crossovers someone is really embraced by a different culture, you know. And Jane Birkin is the most French English woman you could think of, and so Romy Schneider, who started her career in German, crossed over into French and became a big film star. But really, an ordinary, although she was an extremely beautiful woman and a very great actress, really a sort of every woman who again came to play secretaries, very ordinary women who worked.
There's a great line you quote, and then you quote a lovely line by Italo Calvino as well, which is he was interested in what might be called the distinctive atmosphere of French cinema, saturated with pent-up sensuality and a sort of radiant pessimism, and this sort of a grittiness you're talking about here. And then the Italo Calvino quote is, French cinema was heavy with odours, whereas American cinema smelled of palm olive.
Yes, well, I think that, you know, that would tessellate with some of the observations Henry Miller makes when he visits Paris and is struck by those smells of women in particular, but also the street, a certain kind of grime that's very un-American. French cinema is not sanitized in the same way. It has perhaps become more so nowadays, although I would say that distinction still remains.
Do you think it is?
I think there's...
I think so, because, you don't have the French equivalent, do you, of a Hollywood film which is kind of, is almost frictionless, pleases everybody, it's all bright and clean. I can't think what the French equivalent to that sort of... would be. Even the comedies will kind of punch you in the gut if they can.
That's true. And even the comedies that star great stars, you know, Catherine Deneuve, Daniel Auteuil, all people who are nicely familiar, will often have some sort of plot development that would never get through a Hollywood studio.
And presumably they're more relaxed and have always been more relaxed about sex and nudity and things like that, in a way that you have the classic Hollywood image of the people not being seen having sex, but with the sheets put up to
their wearing their underwear in bed, yeah, which is perfectly normal. Obviously, everybody does.
Everyone does that, and then the sheets up to their necks, and you can't see anything. And,
yes.
Oh, well, the French cinema's never been like that, is it? It's, if you're going to see something, it's there to be seen.
I think so. I think, and that ties up also with a certain attitude to morality. Not that there's no morality in French cinema, but there is, and in the 30s and the 40s, you can see that, but it's. There's greater comfort in French films, I think, with leaving things a little bit more open-ended and more ambiguous,
yeah,
than would be tolerated, I think, in an American film of that era and even of the current.
When you see films, French films in the 30s and 40s, does it have the buttoned-up feel of an era that was... It seems like American and British films, you know, you can tell they're never going to say anything racy, they're never going to do anything racy. The morality and the censorship that bred that morality was very, very clear, and it's very obvious when you watch it. Was that the same in France, or was it always more of a libertarian?
It was always more libertarian. I mean, one very good example, and Tavernier does flag it up in his film, is Hôtel du Nord, where Arletty plays, not for the first or last time, a prostitute, a fantastic character. And not only is her character funny, has her own voice, but also absolutely never judged or belittled because of what she does. It's just taken for granted that in this world, in the world of the story, that is what she does.
And she's very... I watched a little bit of it the other day before we were talking about this, and she's very outspoken. There's a very famous scene on a bridge over the canal, and she really yells at him. He's saying, you know this better than me, but he's kind of saying, I've got to get out of here. There's a funny atmosphere around here.
Yes, meaning her, because they are together.
Because it's very claustrophobic, and she really bowls him out. It's really good. It's kind of, you know, it's bracing to watch. And also she's using slang. She's not speaking beautiful proper French. She's just really yelling at him, and she kind of storms off.
And a Hollywood film of that era would be very clipped, received pronunciation, wouldn't it?
I think so, and I think also you wouldn't be. I mean, as you say, Muriel, I think you would. If somebody was to behave like that, you would sort of disapprove of her, or you'd think, oh, she's the kooky one or something. But no, this was the female figure at the centre, and she's really ballsy.
Strong female characters, considering, you know.
And it's not that you kind of morally approve or disapprove. It's just that's who she is. She's there, and it's still very strong, that film.
Just finally, Muriel, if having seen this trot through 40 years of French film, were there any films that you could recommend to people listening to this who don't know very much about French cinema? Go and see this as an example of the sort of cinema we've been talking about.
Picking a favourite, if you can hunt it down, because there's one that's perhaps easier to get hold of than the other. The one that's probably easier to get hold of than the other is Les Choses de la Vie. So Claude Sautet is one, the director he explores it towards the end of the film, who's most productive in the 60s and 70s, and worked with Romy Schneider, worked with the wonderful Michel Piccoli, specifically in a film called Les Choses de la Vie. I'm not quite sure how it's been translated, if it's been translated.
I don't know, actually.
But it's a film about an architect
who... Things of Life.
Things of Life.
Things of Life. Very French title.
Yeah, exactly.
The Things of Life.
That could be all French cinema, couldn't it? We've called it The Things of Life. Yeah.
In The Things of Life, an architect played by Michel Piccoli is typically, for a French movie, torn between his wife and his mistress, has to make a choice between the two. He's driving his car, he crashes his car, and then the film follows his internal monologue as he remembers parts of his life, still wrestling with the decision. It's fantastic. It's one of those films that's always on French television and so is incredibly underrated. So worth getting the DVD if possible.
Lovely, lovely. Muriel Zaga, thank you so much indeed. We're living in a political paradox, a time of tremendous violent change in terms of our tribal and national identities and oddly stable support for the two main parties. Most polls have the Tories and Labour taking around 40% of the vote each, with Labour, despite evident Tory crises, only edging slightly ahead, if at all. So did the party conferences reveal anything? On the Tory side, it perhaps most strikingly revealed a sort of limped resigned somnolence, an absence of ideas or excitement, a conference best symbolised by a coughing Prime Minister and a sign behind her dropping letters as if they represented the will to live. In Labour, we saw triumphalism, excitement, the spectre of quondam enemies of Jeremy Corbyn, like the once proud Tom Watson, crooking the knee and abasing themselves before the all-conquering demigod of the left. Meanwhile, Brexit means perhaps that none of this matters. As James O'Brien puts it succinctly, in short, a Remainer compelled to wear the clothes of a Leaver leads the government, while a lifelong Leaver holding the hopes of Remainers in his hands heads the opposition. What a mess. James O'Brien joins Lucy and me now. James, welcome.
Thank you.
Let's begin at the Tory conference before we head south to Brighton. All the talk was of May's clunker of a speech, but you think, and I think you make a very persuasive argument, it slightly distracted from the message itself, which was perhaps more troubling.
Yes, remarkable really to reflect that the woman who was responsible for the go-home vans for the, according to Vince Cable, the suppression of 9 separate reports, rubbishing the notion that immigration has had a negative impact on wages and employment, and of course the one who still sees the European Union citizens living here as bargaining chips, whatever she may have said to the contrary, tried to establish herself as a sort of inclusive liberal. It tallies with this audit the Cabinet Office have undertaken of sort of race relations, but there's no money behind it and no real, I don't think, will behind it. So having failed to really propel herself to whatever the next stage is by embracing nativism and riding that rather UKIP-y tiger that she appeared to be on top of when she was doing the Brexit means Brexit, the no deal is better than a bad deal. She's now taken almost a complete 180 U-turn. If you actually read the speech, and you have to read it because God knows how anyone could sit through listening to it again. But if you read the actual speech, it's as if there were two Theresa Mays, but to her, I think, good fortune, nobody seemed to notice.
But she's done this before, because remember when she became Prime Minister, she gave that speech on the steps of Downing Street where she effectively lifted the policy position of Ed Miliband. And yes, she talked about this great, you know, just about managings that came out of that speech and caring about people. And at a time when some sort of radical solutions are necessary for society, that looked like she was beginning a journey in that direction and then stopped almost immediately.
I wonder if you touched on it there with the phrase radical solutions, in that her heart may well be right place, although a lot of people would take a lot of persuading of that, not just on the sort of immigration issues, but also on some of the benefit sanctions, some of the other issues she presided over at the Home Office, the detention centres, that sort of thing. But I'm a little bit more, I suppose she's a vicar's daughter, I should say, a little bit more Christian about it. And I think perhaps she does believe what she says on these issues, but hasn't got a Scooby-Doo how to actually deliver it. And when ambition comes up against expectation, that's when she appears to have little choice but to completely change horses.
What do you think of Boris? Not personally, I mean, we could do a whole podcast on what you think of Boris personally.
Boris Johnson.
You don't even like, yeah, we couldn't even call him Boris. Boris
it's
Johnson.
It's too friendly, it's too chummy.
It's too Boris. Chummy.
I agree with you.
That's very much what he wants us to say.
Yeah, Boris. The scheming of Boris Johnson, what happened at conference, and also there's a ridiculous newspaper articles he writes, primarily for the Telegraph, where,
yes,
and then he immediately denies that they mean anything. He sort of said, he writes this sort of policy thing about Brexit, and then when people say, you look like you're mounting a challenge to your leader and pimping yourself out, he says, oh, no, I'm not. What's he up to? Does he know what he's up to?
He's demonstrating two things: complete contempt for the electorate, which has always served him well, and also a belief that he and he alone can get away with murder, can get away with flip-flopping, can get away with having his cake and eating it. And, you know, he's still favourite among Conservative Party rank and file to take over from Theresa May. So I don't know whether I'd go so far as to say he knows what he's doing. I think it's more a case of he's doing all he knows.
Yeah. I mean, there's also a kind of faux demure aspect here for him, because if you had to say, there's two problems for the Tory membership. Arguably, A, they're hostage to their own weakness, aren't they? Because if they get rid of Theresa May, there may well have to be an election which they'll lose. And secondly, if they get rid of...
possibly they'll lose it. They think they might.
But they might, exactly. And then we'll talk about that in a moment, I suspect. But the second thing is, if they got rid of her, if the best they can do is a plot led by Grant Shapps, which is the very definition of a mediocre attempt to do anything. I mean, it couldn't be more mediocre. What, they don't really have any options, do they?
I don't think they do. And it's almost like everybody is waiting to see what happens next. There's this sort of, I think, entirely forlorn hope that there might be some sort of rabbit pulled out of the Brexit Act in the next few months. And similarly, I suppose if that happens, then it shores up Theresa May for a little bit longer. But if the Conservatives felt that they had a viable option who would give Jeremy Corbyn something close to a pasting in the general election, Theresa May's feet wouldn't touch the ground. The fact that the Parliamentary Party clearly don't think that that's Boris Johnson, and he's also, I think, made quite a lot of enemies. Well, at best, alienated people. At worst, made enemies of them.
Is
stymieing his absolutely unvaunted. His ambition is without bounds, isn't it? But the fact that he needs support to get the top job probably explains why he's sort of just pirouetting all the time in the hope of picking up an audience.
Let's go to Labour then, because if you saw the conference, it was this tremendous coronation of and sort of sanctification of Jeremy Corbyn. But what struck me, I don't know if it struck you, is although everyone's opinion of Corbyn has changed, he has changed as well. It's not just their view of him. His view of himself has changed. He's smartened up. It's more professionally handled. It's more hard-hitting in the sense of he cares about message in a way that he was never going to be your typical sort of politician. But in some ways, he's become a bit of a typical sort of politician because he cares about all that surrounding stuff. Do you think that's right?
Without jettisoning anything, that's probably an important caveat. I think you're absolutely right. He is prioritising the pursuit of power in a way that his detractors never thought he would be capable of doing. I suspect he was probably as surprised as anybody else by the general election result. But what it means is that now when he turns up on stage at conference, he is genuinely looking like a prime minister in waiting. And according to that, he's cut his cloth, he's scrubbed up, and he's also, I think, very cleverly, although again this is business as usual and cynical politics, he's avoiding showing too much of what it is with regard to Brexit they probably don't know, but in other areas he's not giving detail, he's not giving them an opportunity to start tugging at the loose thread and watching the whole thing fall apart, which was perhaps a mistake that him and people like Diane Abbott made in the election campaign. Why would you? I mean, look at what's happening. Look at the numbers, albeit that there's an unexpected stagnancy post-conference. But generally speaking, he was 20-odd points out before when the election was called. And now it's, you know, at the very worst from his point of view, it's now neck and neck. So I think just keep giving them what they want and don't rock the boat, which is, of course, the opposite of what he was supposed to represent when he first took the leadership.
I suppose also that since the Tory party does seem to be more or less in disarray, if he just stands still and doesn't muck anything up, he looks very, very good just by doing that.
You're absolutely right. In relief to the Conservative Party, he does. But in relief to again, a theoretical figure, as we said about the Tories, if there was someone around whom the more passionate Remain contingency could coalesce. If Labour had a profoundly charismatic leader at the moment who could speak to people who I don't think Jeremy Corbyn is ever going to quite reach, then it would be as exciting as seeing the Tories have a proper rival to Theresa May coming up on the outside lane. So they're both almost sort of paralysed by their position, but personally I'd much rather be in Jeremy Corbyn's position than Theresa May.
Well, indeed, the last thing that he wants, arguably, is government. If there is a snap election in the next 3 months and Labour got in, it would be disastrous for him and for the party because their split on Brexit, which is not more significant than the Tories, would be raised. And no one wants to preside over the Brexit of the next 2 to 3 to 4 to 5 to however many years. If you were advising Jeremy Corbyn, you'd say, for God's sake, pray not to get into power in the next short-term future.
I think this distorting lens of Brexit absolutely defines everything. And I mean, Theresa May theoretically doesn't want to be in power either, but she's clinging on by her fingertips and would probably chalk it up to a sense of duty. I don't think Jeremy Corbyn has that because duty involves sustaining the status quo, whereas Corbyn's appeal hinges almost entirely upon challenging the status quo. Having said that, be careful what you wish for. You know, maybe there is a rabbit to be pulled out of a hat at some point in the next 6 months. Maybe Corbyn's position, maybe he's peaked. So on the other hand, they might be thinking we'll never have a better position from which to fight a general election. And then left with the question, as you always are, and Corbyn seems to be different from other politicians, of whether actually just simply getting hold of number 10 is more important than anything that happens afterwards, which I would loosely describe as the Boris Johnson position.
Brexit, I mean, we know it's not going to happen until 2021 because of there's going to be a 2-year transition period. Yeah. We don't know what it's going to transition to. I've got this sad vision, James, that this operation kind of status quo, we spend millions of pounds, millions of man hours trying to have something that ends up just slightly worse economically than we have now. And that's kind of the best case scenario. The best case scenario.
I'd take that.
So would I. I think that would be that would be quite a good outcome.
But at one level, it's just the most kind of, it's like a piece of absurdist performance art, isn't it? Mm. That we're going to end up in a situation where we have to get close to the single market, so we have to accept a certain amount of EU regulation and interference that we so stridently resist. The world requires rules and supranational state court-like things to govern them. We want fair trade deals. All of that stuff we're gonna disentangle for the purpose of re-entangling in a slightly worse way over a five-year period.
Yes, but you're doing that thing that involves sort of evidence, detail and rationality. And I find it very difficult to discuss the opposite camp without falling foul of all of those hackneyed accusations of condescension and sneering and all that sort of thing, that you can't reason people out of a position that they haven't been reasoned into, which is why these bovine slogans like taking back control and we've got our country back and Brexit means Brexit resonate so successfully, because they excuse people from the business of thinking, and the more thinking that you do, the more your analysis becomes irresistible.
It's also, I have to say, I feel very sorry for anyone in the civil service who's going to spend the next 4 years, as you say, Stig, unpicking and then picking again, but worse. Meanwhile, working presumably every hour God sends.
You're quite right, yes.
I mean, that's, you know, there won't be the greatest casualties in the whole thing. This is just a kind
And they'll
of,
probably
you know,
end up carrying the can, because people who won't carry the can are the people that have led us to this. So the EU will be blamed for intransigence. Remainers will be blamed for somehow sapping morale. Absolutely, all of this. But none of the people who said it was going to be brilliant will be responsible when it turns out to be anything but, with the obvious parenthesis that, please God, it does turn out better than any of us expect.
Well, and I think I've been talking to people inside government and in the civil service, and it's not an ideological question. Look, and we've discussed this before, James, but I can buy a notion of sovereignty as an ideal. I can buy the
of
idea
course.
That we should be able to get rid of politicians who cause problems in certain areas, and if certain decisions are being taken outside of our sovereign control, that's a legitimate idea to debate about and pursue. But on the pure pragmatism, that's the thing that I find most frustrating. You talk to civil servants. If you were trying to merge two companies or demerge two companies, it's a vast amount of work that takes years and years and years, and you've got to be very certain of it. And it's that magnified
don't
by...
Don't be so downbeat. Don't call the country down, Stig.
Don't
it's all
be a
going
saboteur.
To be absolutely fine. And that would have passed a satire 6 months ago, but now it is pretty much an impression of Liam Fox and David Davis.
Yeah.
They just still seem to be blithely suggesting that anybody's suggesting that... Yeah, I think the line I used in the last piece I wrote for you was withdrawing the eggs from a baked cake.
Yeah.
And, you know, that they insist on pretending that it's not like that at all.
Let's move away off Brexit just finally, because I'm interested in where you think the country is politically, because I have in my mind this view that we're finally seeing the consequences of the 2008 banking crisis. We're finally seeing the legacy of that. And weirdly, you'd expect that to have hit the 2010 election. It didn't. The 2015 election, it didn't. And then we kind of assumed, or I naively assumed, well, maybe it's never going to hit. But it feels to me that we are seeing the consequences of that writ in the political system, and that may be shifting politics' centre of gravity leftwards. Do you think that's correct?
I think in the sense of we can't carry on like this, and that perhaps was brought into sharper relief by the financial crisis. And without being repetitive, obviously the Brexit stuff distorts anything that attempts to be an overview of that kind of thing. But the notion of nationalisation is profit, isn't it? And what the financial crisis proved was what happened when profiteering goes unchecked. You can use whatever trendy word you want to describe toxic capitalism or crony capitalism. There's nothing wrong with capitalism as long as some of the profits make their way back into the people generating the profits and some of the money makes its way back into the businesses for growth and research and development. What we saw in the banking crisis is what happens when it's all about shoveling as much cash out of the pockets of ordinary people into the pockets of very rich people that you can do. So yes, I think that explains why there's an enthusiasm for nationalisation, why there's an enthusiasm for redistribution of wealth, the notion that the state has to play a role in this. If you somehow don't get a berth on the gravy train, then it must somehow be your fault. That seems to me to be expiring. But again, you know, I'd hesitate to put money on anything at the moment that passes for an overview.
Well, what it seems to me to say at the very least is that that scenario fits a Jeremy Corbyn view of the world.
So. And he means it. Don't forget that.
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, this is the drum he's been beating for the best part of four decades, so no one could accuse him of opportunism.
But but I guess the challenge is for then, this is why what people wanted from, if you're a Conservative, what you wanted from Theresa May's speech and the conference generally was this excited moment of recalibrating what conservatism, what the other side of the ball might look like as a way of answering those problems. And that to me is, it feels, where they seem to lack any invention or any energy.
Yes. Well, I mean, what can she do when the infighting is magnified beyond all recognition by the fact that Brexit is looming behind her? Every single thing, how can she lay out a vision of social inclusion or a return to one nation values when we don't even know whether the one nation that we've currently got is going to survive Brexit when you look at the Irish border? It's one nation that could be shrinking within 5 or 6 years.
Everything comes back to Brexit.
It just
doesn't it?
Does. I know it's repetitious and arguably dull, but it's just true.
Well, it must kill you, James, doing it every day on the radio. I just think that the problem, because it's every, because you can't really, as you say, we've demonstrated, you can't really talk anything without Brexit's shadow looming over it in some respects or others.
I'm trying to work out how you do this thing of putting your fingers in your ears and pretending that it isn't.
Ask
looming them. Over everything.
Yeah. Ask the people negotiating for Brexit. Ask the Three Musketeers. They're pretty good at it.
Well, they are, aren't they? And that has to be the next chapter, doesn't it? One of them has to either fall under the wheels of the £350 million bus or kind of own up.
Or drive it heroically into the sunset, is what they would believe.
But I think what a time to be alive.
I know that.
You know, I now know why the Chinese proverb always says, may you live in interesting times. I never really understood why that was a curse before.
Yeah, exactly. Won't people think of the poor radio host who I've got to talk about this all the time? You're the true victims of Brexit.
Thank you, exactly.
Yeah, finally. James O'Brien, thank you very much indeed.
Thank you very much.
So it all comes back to Brexit again. But did you buy the fact that we're shifting centre-left?
I don't know. I think that the Labour Party, is much more unified now, obviously, than it was last year, and they're all terribly happy about that, which is they're all chanting and singing, and that's fine. I'm not sure if they have persuaded the rest of the country, but even if they had, and even if everyone had gone terribly left-wing and we started renationalising everything, then you've still got Brexit there. So you've still got... I don't see how we could get on with that programme.
Well, there's an argument that you need Brexit to renationalise properly because European Union rules require there to be market competition.
But you
which
can't
is why
do
Corbyn's
anything until it's actually done.
No, and actually,
so
and
you'd
I'm,
be stuck.
And I'm talking about anyway, but you know, as I said at the very beginning, 40-40, 40% of the country votes Tory at the minute. And in fact, the last election, 43% voted Tory and 41% voted Labour. That's an incredibly high number. So although it feels like the centre of gravity might be shifting left, you can make it a case. In fact, there is no centre of gravity anymore. You're either on the side of one or the side of the other. That kind of middle ground that was up for grabs.
Yes,
that
which
Blair
is,
got.
Exactly, which is where Tony Blair was. I mean, and it's like the referendum. It's like the Brexit referendum. It's like the Scottish referendum. It's like, they're close. The numbers seem to be staying about the same, which is a bit of a bind.
And they're binary. That's the other thing. They're close in numbers,
and
but they're poles
apart.
And it's
becoming more tribal, which I think is a problem.
Yeah. Well, that was cheery then. Thank you.
Sorry about that.
The TLS's very own Samuel Graydon has been sent from the imposing towers here to visit the National Poetry Library, sited in the Royal Festival Hall. There he spoke to Chris McCabe, the librarian and poet in his own right, about the 50th anniversary of the Poetry International Festival, which was set up by Ted Hughes in 1967. Sam talked to Chris about the festival, but began by asking about the library itself.
The library was set up in 1953 by the Arts Council, and the idea was that it'd be a place where people could come and find out about what was happening in poetry. So it was opened by T.S. Eliot. He did a speech at the time, but annoyingly, what he said was never saved.
So we
don't really know what he said, but he obviously thought it was a good thing because he came out that day and opened it. So the library had different homes across London. It was based in Earls Court for a while, Piccadilly, Covent Garden, and it came here to South Bank Centre. And by the time the library came here in 1988, the Poetry International Festival had been going for quite some time. It had been set up in 67, but it had kind of lapsed and it had stopped and started the festival.
Okay.
And it was 1988 where the festival relaunched with a new focus,
yeah.
And that was at the exact moment when the library had come to the centre as well. So there was a kind of a nice sense of coming together of these different poetry kind of traditions and institutions, if you like.
And you said 67 Poetry International, which
yep.
turns 50 this year. That was set up by Ted Hughes, I think.
That's right, yeah. So Ted Hughes was the director, but actually only for a very short period.
Right.
In the years running up to Poetry International, Ted Hughes had been behind a magazine called Modern Poetry and Translation, which he co-edited with Daniel Weisbord. And it was part of this interest that he had in international poetry and bringing poets together from around the world. So we can start to think about the tensions and the problems in the world through the lens of poetry and what that might be able to do in terms of bringing people together and sharing a common language of poetry, actually, was one of his big aims. Ted actually soon relinquished his directorship because the Poetry Book Society were very keen that people should come to the festival and that there would be an audience.
Of course.
but that wasn't really... that wasn't really of so much interest to Ted himself, so much as, kind of bringing the best poets from across Europe, across the Cold War divide was really his aim.
Hughes's aim was a political kind of statement about poetry and its possibility for bringing people together.
Yep.
Has that aim developed over the years?
Well, it's, we've been really digging through the archives for the 50-year anniversary. We've got an exhibition which happens in the National Poetry Library and the South Bank Centre's archive studio. So we're going to be showing...
And that's coming up on the weekend.
No? That's coming up at the weekend of the festival, yes. Yeah. So people will be able to come in and really dig into, the history of the festival and the kind of major moments of the festival. But, Ted Hughes' aim was to... to bring people together, to bring poets together.
Mm.
He said poetry is a universal language in which we can all hope to meet. Whether or not the festival's achieved that, I think, depends on which version of the festival you look at, what was happening at the time. In fact, the first festival was criticised by a black poet, James Berry, for not including enough black poets.
Right. So the 67.
That was the 67 one. And, throughout the different incarnations of the festival, you can see that sometimes it's been more politically driven than others.
Right.
Often there's a lot of UK poets. Auden appeared a lot in the early festivals. When we get to the 90s, we see a lot of the new generation poets appearing, Caroline Duffy, Simon Armitage, always offset with poets who've been invited from other countries. But sometimes the political impetus has perhaps been less sharp than others. And I really think the last... since 1988, really, we've seen more of a focus, more of an engagement with world politics through the festival.
Right.
But particularly since 2010, I think, with an engagement around issues in the Middle East,
right.
Afghanistan, for example, the festival organisers have really endeavoured to show the problems that are existing through the world and how the poets in those communities are... very much on the ground addressing those issues, and it's a chance for us to understand what those issues are, but also what poetry can say about them, what poetry can do with those issues. That's really the driving force, I'd say, of the festival now.
And I noticed on the weekend you have another event which talks about how poetry has changed over 50 years.
Yep.
And so we have the festival changing and becoming more political. Would you say that that's reflected in the poetry that you're drawing to the festival? Or is it a more political kind of poetry you're aiming for?
Yes, I think it is. We have a number of really key events happening at this year's festival. We've got an event on eco-poetry, which is bringing together poets who are addressing the environment and climate change. That's one event. We've got an event which is called... Home is the Mouth of a Shark, which is about refugees. It's about movement, from different countries, either enforced or through choice. But again, poets who've had to leave their home, and how that comes through their poetry as a major kind of theme of what they think their poetic mission is to achieve. And throughout it all, we've got this theme of endangered languages. The National Poetry Library, we've launched the Endangered Poetry Project, and we are trying to collect poems in endangered languages, because languages are dying out at a phenomenal rate.
Indeed, yes.
You know, one every 2 weeks, according to UNESCO, and half the world's languages will be lost by the end of the century.
Wow.
And with that, obviously, goes the poems that have been written in those languages and what they can tell us about humans throughout the world. So we launched this project on National Poetry Day, and over the last week already, we've been receiving poems from the public in Faroese, Alsatian, Breton.
Oh, wow.
And that we're going to be able to show these poems, what we've had so far, in the exhibition. And we've also got a brilliant event called 7,000 Words for Human, which shows four commissions by major international poets to write a poem in an endangered language that they know. And working with our translator in residence, Stephen Watts, he's going to make an English version so we can get a sense of those issues that are running through those poems.
Talking about the archive briefly, you've brought some stuff from the archive for me to see, which I'm quite excited about.
Yeah.
So if you could show me those things, that'd be wonderful.
Yeah, so what you can see here is the brochure for the very first Poetry International Festival.
Oh, wow.
And you can see it's got a very kind of almost psychedelic kind of design.
It does, yes.
Yeah, kind of fits in with...
like some kind of Jimi Hendrix poster.
With the time. Yeah, it does look like a poster for a Jimi Hendrix gig. Hendrix never appeared, but a number of great poets did. Just looking through the names.
Yeah. I can see Berryman.
John Berryman came to the festival. Allen Ginsberg came to the festival. He was actually photographed outside the Queen Elizabeth Hall with a huge God's Eye, it was called, and a kind of Mexican medallion that he had around his neck, which looked quite odd because he was wearing a suit at the time.
Oh, of course.
Yeah, yeah, sorry. And Charles Olson came, the American experimental poet, all 6'8" of him.
Wow.
And he chose to sit on the steps leading down to the Queen Elizabeth Hall stage rather than go on the stage. He was being quite awkward and difficult that day, but he went up and he read. He did a brilliant reading. Auden came. Auden was W.H. Auden was a fixture throughout.
As you said,
actually,
yes.
the festivals in those early years. You know, you can easily, on the one sense, you can be kind of struck just by how amazing it is to bring these names that we all know from poetry's past together. But it's, you know, very male. That goes.
We have a few women.
Although I've got a somebody at the festival actually kept a scripted run through of what actually happened at this first event, and you can see one of the women, Anne Sexton, American poet. She never actually made it to the festival. She was supposed to, but she never read. So that was one of the. One of the three women, I think, kind of disappeared straight away. And, it, you know, it was a very, very white festival as well. So,
hence the criticism.
Hence the criticism at the time. So that runs through. I've got this LP from the 1969 festival.
Yes, I know. You've got a whole collection of LPs.
Poetry readings. Well, vinyl's coming back in. And luckily, we've held onto ours at the National Poetry Library. And you can see there's this gathering on the what I think is the Queen Elizabeth Hall roof. Of again, all male poets, unfortunately. Ogden Nash, W.A. Jordan, Derek Walcott, and they're having a glass of wine, kind of mulling over the state of the world, we hope. at least their view of it. But it caused a lot of controversy those first few years. There's an article actually from the TLS in the 1967, which talks about what happened. And it says the organisers of Poetry International 67 could hardly have hoped for a better publicity boost than they received from Donald Davies' eccentric outburst in The Guardian just 3 days before last week's festival was due to open. Go home, Octavia Path, snarled the scandalised professor. Go home, every good poet who has been lured to London this week. And what Donald Davies was set against, like a lot of people at the time, was the pointlessness of live readings. This was quite a new thing.
Oh, right.
Yeah. We'd had the incarnation at the Albert Hall a few years before, the famous gathering where poets like Allen Ginsberg and Adrian Henry appeared on stage. But this was still quite a new thing, and a lot of people just couldn't see how
it
had couldn't see the point. What's it got to do with poetry? Poetry is what you get in books. Poetry is what you read on the page. So, you know, it was kind of a transitional point for poetry, I guess. We're so used now to poetry being a spoken thing, a performance thing. But the establishment of this festival was really part of that move towards, I guess, the cultivation of the personality.
Yes.
The sound of the voice, the movement on stage, the live audience, which we now know doesn't detract from the page. It's another way of experience
and contemporary way of presenting. And also quite a good engagement of the public, and I guess that's what the festival's about as well, as drawing people into poetry.
And I think what's been what I've said makes it sound like a really dry kind of serious kind of thing, and it was, you know, in its intentions. But when you look at the festival through the years, there have been lots of participatory events, lots of fun events. In 1972, Dame Edna Everidge came to do an event on Australian kind of naive verse, if you like, kind of poems that are just being written by people who weren't necessarily poets. Barry Humphreys, who of course is the other half of Dame Edna Everidge. Absolutely. They came on, he was on stage, and the person who introduced it said, you can see Barry Humphreys is here, but Dame Edna Everidge has actually gone to the Royal Albert Hall because she couldn't believe that any venue that had less than 6,000 seats could be the right venue for her to be performing it. Sure enough, by the second half of the event, she's appeared. And she read some very funny and strange things, including a poem called Pig Face, which is not what you've got in mind when you see the kind of first kind of visions of what the festival would be. But of course, you know, it's got to engage people who are at different levels with poetry, who have different expectations. I think there has been a strand of fun, actually, and humour running through the festivals since those early days.
Oh, well, good. It's nice to know that it's not all...
Yeah, no, come along and you'll be surprised. There's lots of fun things happening.
We've looked at the past. What do you see as the future for the festival? Where do you see it developing?
In a really straightforward way, it will reflect more aspects of humanity. You know, it's not about aged white men. It's going to be about anybody living, breathing and writing poetry or wanting to read poetry. You know, it's a festival that is for everyone. And that really reflects in this year's programme as well. The big highlight gala event, which will close the festival, the unmissable event, I'd say, is the World Poetry Summit. And this is on Sunday the 15th of October. And we're gathering together some of the most exciting radical poets who are writing at the moment. So we've got Claudia Rankin, who many people know has written a book called Citizen, which investigates the kind of microaggressions and hidden racisms that are occurring in society. She's got to come and read from that book for us. We've got Anne Carson, a wonderful, inventive poet
who
often crosses across mediums and forms and challenges our expectations of what poetry is and what it can be. And we have Joy Harjo, who is a poet who has been commissioned as well to write a poem from her native language, Muscovy, and she's going to read for us live on stage as well. She's an incredible performer. She often includes music in her performance as well. So we've got this real mix of different approaches to poetry, different styles, and I think, you know, that's what the future of the festival is about. It's about including just this various art that poetry is, the kind of the plurality of what can be done in it. You know, there's no rules at all in poetry, and I think any ideas we had, even over the last few decades of what poetry might be expected to do, have been ripped up and rewritten by poets over the last 10 years.
Chris McCabe talking to Sam Graydon. That's all we have time for this week. Our thanks go to Sam Graydon and Chris McCabe, Muriel Zagger and James O'Brien. Lucy, have you had fun?
Of course, apart from all the politics is a bit depressing. But
politics is depressing, but French cinema, is that
always
depressing?
No, it's not depressing.
There's probably this gloomy aspects to it.
It's very stylish.
It is stylish. I got the sense from
it's
that.
It's enjoyable, even when it is a bit bleak.
Even if people are shrugging and saying bof.
Bof, yeah, which they are. Yeah.
Has anyone in France ever said bof in reality?
All the time.
Both.
All the time.
It's a real thing.
Yeah.
It's not a cliche.
Well, it's, I mean, it is also a cliche.
If I was having a dispute with a French person, they would go, oh, bof, that would be normal.
Well, it's not so much. It's more like, you know, if you said, do you want the green one or the blue one? And you went, bof. You would say bof. Yeah, I absolutely would say bof.
Bof. Yeah. Bof. Do you go to the-tls.co.uk to see this week's edition of the paper, which is full of film, including a profile of gun-toting Charlton Heston and the story of five women writers who changed the world. Do join us next week when Theo will probably be back, and we shall discuss matters artistic as part of an art history special of the paper. Until then, from Lucy and from me, goodbye.